Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us tonight for our monthly Trib Talk Live, Fake or Fact, What is News? I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. I'm the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. We're thrilled to be here at the City Library in the downtown Salt Lake City with a live audience, and also a special welcome to our radio audience listening live on KCPW and our streaming audience at sltrib.com. When we talk about fake news, what we're really describing is deliberately false stories circulated solely for the purpose of financial or political gain. Now, these stories can be disorienting and confusing for readers, but what does the phenomenon do? Does it shake the foundations of democracy, as some fear? Tonight we're going to talk about the implications that fake news has on society with some very distinguished guests. And joining me to my extreme left, ideologically and geographically, Matthew LaPlante. Matthew LaPlante. Matt's reporting has taken him from Iraq to Ethiopia to El Salvador and beyond. His work has been featured in the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Daily News, CNN, and Christianity Today. He is co-writer on two books about scientific discovery. He was, once upon a time, a staff reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune from 2004 to 2011, and then he left us to join the faculty at Utah State University, where he now teaches news writing, crisis reporting, and feature writing. Matt, it's so great to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Galen Henderson is with us. She is an associate professor in the English and Literature Department at Utah Valley University, and she is co-editor of a scholarly collection of articles titled Propaganda and Rhetoric in Democracy. How apt. The book was published in October by Southern Illinois University Press, and she teaches courses in rhetorical theory, propaganda, and writing. Galen, thank you so much for making the drive.
I'm happy to be here.
And finally, well, never last, never least, George Pyle. Editorial writer extraordinaire, columnist, blogger for the Salt Lake Tribune since 2002. Before that, he worked as a reporter, editor, and editorial writer for what was, until recently, a family-owned group of newspapers in Kansas. And he was also the co-host of a daily Crossfire-style radio program. He has a degree in journalism from Wichita State University, and he was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing in 1998. George, thank you so much for all you do. Okay, before we begin with our panelists, I really want to get a sense of where you, the audience, is when it comes to fake news. So we're going to do a quick survey. First question, have you ever been fooled by a fake news story? So to join in this live survey, send me a text. The number is 22333. That's 22333. And then in the message, put my initials, J.N. Pierce, J.N.P.E.A.R.C.E. And then that's in the message field. And then the letter A, if you want to answer yes, or the letter B, if you want to answer no. Oh, somebody got it. Excellent. For our radio audience, there is a visual showing the percentages. Have you ever been fooled by a fake news story? And the percentages right now are at 75% yes, 82%, 18% no. We'll keep the poll open for just another couple seconds. Based on these answers, it does appear that the vast majority of you have been fooled by a fake news story. We'll go to the next question. Right now we're 86% yes. The next question, have you ever shared a story, either intentionally or unintentionally, that proved not to be true? So have you shared a fake news story? Again, in the message field, A for yes, B for no. And on this one, it appears that you're not sharing as many fake news stories as you're believing. I'm not sure what that says about you, but... Another couple seconds. Looks like we're settling right around 54% for no, never having shared a fake news story. 40-something percent, yes. Okay, a few quick questions. A little game that we're going to call Fake or Fact. So, I'm going to show you a few stories. This is a story about a teenager who wrestled an alligator to impress a girl. So, fake or fact? If you think it's fake, A. If you think it's fact, B. Oh gosh, the numbers are vacillating. There's a lot of insecurity out there. I'm going to say that the vast majority of you are saying that this was fact. We're up in the 60 percentages. Ding, ding, ding. Yes, you are right. It was fact, widely reported in the Washington Post, Sky News, multiple newspapers in Australia where this happened. Okay. Here's another one. The Irish slave trade, the slaves that time forgot. Fake or fact? Okay, here come the tallies. This one seems to be a little bit harder for our audience members. Registering slightly toward the fake, just barely. 53, 54% fake and 47% fact. Fake. Showed up on a site called Newport Buzz. It was discredited by Snopes and others. Okay, that's just getting you warmed up. Okay, how about this one? Story about Whoopi Goldberg criticizing the wife of a Navy SEAL who was honored during President Trump's address to a joint session of Congress. Fake or fact? Okay. The number is sliding up and down. You guys cannot decide. What does that say about Whoopi Goldberg, right? Fake or fact? Did she criticize the Navy SEAL widow? Okay, looks like it's settled. 63% say fake, 37% say fact. You got it. Fake. So, in fact, this was published on a site called Underground News Report. Is that a giveaway or what? And Whoopi Goldberg actually has threatened to sue the author. So, one final. Okay, so this is the headline. A Texas woman voted like a U.S. citizen, only she wasn't. Fake or fact? Non-citizen voting. It's so funny to see these numbers change. I'm thinking that most of you are settling, though, that this is factual. Am I correct? About 64% of you think it's fact, and you are correct. This was actually published in the New York Times. So I guess my first question to my panelists will be the first question that I ask the audience. Have you ever been fooled by a fake news story? Matt?
Fooled and shared or fooled?
Take your pick.
So just the other day, I was scrolling through Facebook, and I see this video announcing Harry Potter Go, which is a combination of Harry Potter and Pokemon Go. And I immediately go, oh my God, Heidi needs to know about this. My wife has to hear. My wife, who loves Harry Potter and loves Pokemon Go, playing it with our daughter. And I'm just about ready to share it with her. And I go, you know what? I have been telling my students and writing op-eds for a while about not letting the things that you want to be true be the things that you share. But the video was so compelling. I mean, it looked real. They had a little video of the video game. They had a release date. It was kind of like this, like, boom, 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 kind of like a movie trailers, you know, like, in a world. And, but I said, okay, so I'll check. And sure enough, there is no such thing, much to my disappointment, as Harry Potter Go. It was an elaborate hoax. But the reason I didn't share. So I got fooled. I did not share. The reason I got fooled is because I wanted it to be true. But the reason why none of you who are my Facebook friends got fooled, at least not of my responsibilities, because I checked. Okay.
Galen.
I can't really remember whether or not I was fooled. I mean, some of those headlines tonight, I wasn't sure, right? But I think we're all vulnerable, and I think it's because the methodologies are getting so sophisticated. Video, photographs, so we really have to work on being very critical, I think, and thinking through things. But there's more evidence if you can see more than the headline. The headline, it's really hard to tell just from that.
That's the one thing that I discovered. I mean, clickbait, you think that you can distinguish based on a headline, but you really can't. I mean, the New York Times headline was just as clickbaity as anything out there. George, have you been fooled?
You know, I don't think so. After being in this business all these years, I think I'm more likely to disbelieve something that turns out to be true. And I want to click through and check. And some of these examples you had, I recognized the typeface and the style of the New York Times and the Washington Post, so I figured those were probably true. The one about Whoopi Goldberg, I might have bought because it's people who are on these TV shows where they have to just talk and say the first thing that comes into their head and just to fill the time. She might well have said something like that just because, you know, they work each other up into a frenzy and they start an argument. And they're not really in the news business. They're in the entertainment business. So they might say all kinds of outrageous things. And they might walk them back later or they might sue somebody. I know when I was much younger, I was very much interested in things like space aliens built the pyramids and Area 51, and I thought that was really cool. And I don't know that I ever really believed it. I just thought, well, that's pretty cool. I wonder if that's true. So I'd read the books, but they weren't in the newspapers. You know, there were books, there were movies, and they were in the supermarket tabloids. And so, but like I said, now I'm more likely to disbelieve when they said the guy took the machine gun into the pizza place because he had read on fake news that it was a child prostitution ring. Not only did I not believe it was a child prostitution ring, I didn't believe anybody would take a machine gun into a pizza place because of something they read on fake news. Turned out he had.
Well, I guess to Matt's point, part of the appeal is if you want to believe it, it's just more enticing. Is fake news new, Galen?
I don't think so. I think it's a new instance of something that's been around for a long time. We used to call it corporate press release at times. Or propaganda itself. I think that larger term. And I think that what we have now is something designed for social media. So it's a new iteration of something that I think has been around for quite a while.
Well, maybe since you're the resident expert on propaganda, what's the distinction between fake news and propaganda?
Well, I've spent some time thinking about that. And one of the definitions that I think of propaganda that is best actually comes from a University of Utah professor, Thomas Hucken, and he has done research and culled all the definitions of propaganda that are out there, and he's come up with a five-part definition. So I'm going to see if I can remember all of it, but see if you think it fits fake news, because for me it does. False or misleading information, number one. Number two, directed to a mass audience. Three, for the profit or benefit of the producer, either in power or money. And number four, disseminated on purpose, deliberately, sometimes systematically. And five, does not invite any kind of critical dialogue or response doesn't indicate that there might be a dissenting opinion. So that's his definition of propaganda, which I really like. And I think fake news does fit under that, but it has other more specific characteristics, right? It's written as a news story, and it's posted on social media, and it has the clickbait aspect of trying to get people to share it. So it's more specific.
What are your thoughts on the social media raw aspect, that's contributing to the rise of fake news?
Yeah. I think it just makes it, like everything else in our world right now, everything's sped up. So fake news is not new, right? I mean, fake news is as old as news. We've been lying about things in print for a very, very long time. We will be lying about things with digital ones and zeros for as long as we have digital ones and zeros. The difference today is that we are all far more complicit as a society than we ever have been before. Because we now have the power to be personal publishers, and we all have our own audiences and own eyeballs that follow us around on social media, we have become part of the problem, as part of the amplification of fake news. So
before it was relegated to those who had a printing press, but now all of us can propagate this fake news?
Right. I mean, the old saying is, you know, don't pick a fight with somebody who buys ink by the barrel, right? But now we all buy ink by the barrel, right? Figuratively speaking. And that's the problem. It's also an opportunity, though, because we also can address each other and we can let each other know. We have that publishing power now. If I wanted to tell the Washington Post back in the days of Watergate that I thought that Woodward and Bernstein were full of baloney, I had to sit down at a typewriter, pound out a letter, put it in the mail, and like a week later it would get to Washington, and then it might maybe possibly wind up on somebody's desk. Right? So my ability to be part of that conversation was very, very small. And my position of power relative to the Washington Post was very, very small. Now, if I want to call the Washington Post on things, which I do on a regular basis, I can. I can tweet about it. I can Facebook about it. And if I'm really mad, I can get a bunch of my friends to do the same thing. There's some people in the audience right now. Their son today posted on Facebook that he's really mad at the people who made his washer and dryer. Because the dryer broke. It's out of warranty, but it broke, and he found online that there's a bunch of other people complaining about the same problem. And within the course of a few hours, he's developed a constituency, and they're all tweeting and Facebooking at this group, right? That's an act of journalism, and it's an act where social media can be used to speak truth to power. And so that's the other thing that we have today, too. So yeah, social media is the worst thing in the world. It's also the best thing in the world when it comes to fake news.
So when we talk about the social media aspect, it's not just the reach is farther and wider, but there's immediacy to it, right, George?
Yeah, I mean, I was just before we started, I was going to send out a tweet, I'm here and you should listen, you should watch, you should come by. And my Twitter app didn't open for 7 seconds. And I'm going, come on. And... You know
it has to go to a satellite and then come back down?
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of a fake news explanation as to why it didn't work. It had to be censored by the Illuminati or something before it could go out. And so, Carrie Fisher said, we are the generation who stands by the microwave and says, hurry up! And the speed is a large part of it. And also, I mean, I think people have found out that a lot of the fake news that is shared, people who share it haven't even read it. They just read the headline, and they say, oh, that's interesting, and they share it. And the idea that they have taken any responsibility at all for telling their friends something that's true, I mean, that isn't even enter into it. Nobody even claimed that people who share it really aren't taking a chance to say, well, this is true, you should know about it. It's just kind of, this is neat, this is fun, this is interesting, why don't you read it? And a lot of times, people on the comments on the Tribune website, somebody will comment on a story or an editorial, and then the next comment down is, you obviously didn't read the story. And they didn't. You can tell that, or they didn't read the whole story, because they will say, well, why didn't you say this, or how about that? And you left that out. And it was in the story, but they just read the headline, maybe the first couple of lines. They bring their own idea to it. They just assume that, you know, you evil people aren't going to agree with me and I'm going to call you out before they've even read the story to know if they disagree with it.
What part of fake news, though, is just humor? I mean, you said that it needs to be for financial or political gain. Right. But we have all of this political satire that's out there. They're peddling fake news, right? But it's for a different purpose. So can it be called fake news?
I don't think so. I mean, it's satire. And so it's fake news written for the satiric effect. So it's a little bit different. And I love satire, and I think a lot of people do. It's fun. It's almost cathartic, right? We're upset about something. We turn on The Late Show. We see Stephen Colbert. And he pulled out his persona of, you know, from the Colbert Report on Monday night to talk about the defend the Trump budget. And he said, okay, Meals on Wheels, the reason we have to cut Meals on Wheels is because it's not meeting its objective. He said, we started in the 70s to feed all these old people and now they're dead.
Obviously it didn't work.
We enjoy it. It makes us laugh. Now, I've seen research on the Colbert Report that showed that some people took it literally. And so I guess that is the danger, right, of satire. And I think there could be one other danger, and that is we're satisfied. You know, we have that cathartic effect, and then we don't go out and do anything politically. We just enjoy the satire.
Well, that's been happening with The Onion for years. Yeah. I mean, some of those stories are just so outrageous, and people will mistake them for truth. And so, I don't know, Matt, what's the difference now?
I mean, again, it's imminently more shareable. I mean, you know, P.T. Barnum said there was a sucker born every minute. Actually, I haven't fact-checked that. Can somebody fact-check that for me? P.T. Barnum allegedly said there was a sucker born every minute. There's a lot more than that.
I've tried so many times to put a quote in an editorial from somebody famous, and then I look
and
it
you
up,
find
and it
out.
Turns out
yeah.
they didn't say it. Oh, man.
So that's part of the problem. We just have more suckers with more publishing power than ever. But I take a little bit of umbrage to the idea that fake news, by definition, has to be done for political or financial gain. That takes the responsibility off of all of us, right? I didn't do it for financial gain. I just got fooled, so no big deal. No, it is a big deal. It is a really big deal. A lot of people in this room have more Twitter followers and Facebook friends than the first newspaper that I worked for had subscribers. It is a big deal, no matter if you're like benefiting from it financially or politically or not. When you share lies, you're a liar.
Can I add something?
Please.
But some people are making a lot of money. And so there was an NPR expose of Justin Kohler, who was a fake news purveyor, and they tracked him down, and it took a lot of work. And the story they were tracking was FBI agent found dead that was supposedly looking into Clinton emails, right? So completely false story. But they did a lot of tracking, and they went to this man's front door. And he didn't want to talk to him, and then later he agreed to an interview. He owns a company called Disinfomedia. You know, very appropriate name, right? Disinformation Media. And he admitted that he, during the election campaign, that he hires 20 or had hired 20 to 25 writers, that his personal income from this was $10,000 to $30,000 a month. And so one of my questions is, aren't young people who have student debt and have healthcare issues, you know, going to be seduced by this opportunity, like the Breaking Bad syndrome, right?
Get young people. I want to get into this game.
Yeah, we're right. In the wrong business.
Let's turn to politics then. I mean, what effect do you think fake news had on election 2016? George?
Well, probably the big thing that broke right toward the end wasn't really fake news. I mean, when the FBI director said they were reopening or might be reopening, you know, the investigation of Hillary's emails, and it was the whole front page of the New York Times, that wasn't fake because he did say that, and they were doing that. But looking back on it, it was so misplayed and so overblown, and now we know they were also, at the same time, looking into Donald Trump's or his people's alleged connections to the Russian government, the Russian intelligence agencies, the Russian oligarchs, and he didn't tell us that. Is an act of omission fake news? So a lot of it is not lies. A lot of it is just overblown, misplayed, being in a big hurry to catch up and have the news before anybody else. And, you know, most mistakes that you see in newspapers for 100 years have been somebody who got in too much of a hurry and wanted to beat somebody else to the punch and later came to regret it.
Political effects of fake news on the election. I know it seems so long ago now, November.
This isn't the first election that's been swung by bad news or untrue news. It won't be the last. So while I acknowledge that it could certainly play a role, the idea that when we throw our hands in the air and go, oh, holy, holy, this is like ruined democracy, this isn't new. It's not.
And so much of it is, I mean, people who were already inclined to believe bad things about Clinton and good things about Trump still were at the end of the election. They would read the things that reinforced their prejudices, but I don't think probably there were very many people who in September were for Clinton and went for Trump because of fake news or vice versa. They were more likely to read fake news and real news that fit their prejudices, that we call it confirmation bias, and said, well, see, I told you. And
so why are we all worried about this then?
I mean, this is a really good point, though. The more likely you are to have believed fake news, the more likely you were already to have had a bias in favor of the person you were going to vote for anyway.
Well, maybe we're worried about it because people have been ingesting or reading this fake news for years and years and years, and that's where their biases come from. And so these kinds of journalism that really aren't very thoughtful and only give one side of the story, maybe talk radio would be one example that I might think about. I mean, I don't know if it fits exactly our definition of fake news, but people are being influenced. And so I'm concerned about it. I don't think it's just, well, it's, you know, don't worry about it. I think it's a big deal.
Don't you think, though, they're far more influenced by the bubbles that they already exist in? I mean, I know that we got a little bit of a chicken and an egg thing going on here.
Yeah, the silo effect.
Right. I mean, people are constantly, you know, surround themselves, and we have a better ability today to do that than we have in a very long time, to surround ourselves with opinions that just sound like our own opinions. It almost doesn't even matter what's real or what's fake at that point, because everything's just self-confirming, isn't it?
Well, if we're just in this, like, I know people that say, well, I really don't know what's true anymore. So I'm just going to withdraw. I'm just going to withdraw from even looking at the news. I'm just going to pay attention to my family, things I can control. I don't even want to get involved because I don't know what's true. And so I see that as a problem. And so
I see that as a cop out.
I want to fight it. I want to fight it if we can. So, you know, as an educator, I sort of feel that's my responsibility. George?
Well, yeah, to some degree, the audience, the consumer, is going to have to take some responsibility for what they read. And if you don't want to have some agency come in or have Mark Zuckerberg come in and say, you, and you, you're banned. You know, I don't think we want anybody to do that. We don't trust anybody enough to give them that power. The whole idea of free speech and free press is meaningless if the consumer isn't aware and doesn't do their job. I mean, the people who wrote the First Amendment never in their life saw an unbiased newspaper. you just as well explain curved space to them. They weren't going to get it. And yet they wrote the First Amendment to protect the press and speech. And the idea of a newspaper that seeks to tell the truth as best they can, that seeks to be unbiased, at least in its news columns, that's a short-lived phenomenon, maybe since World War II. I mean, before that, you know, news towns of any size had 2-3 competing newspapers, and, you know, they would take different lines. You'd have the Republican newspaper and the Democratic newspaper, and people knew that, and they would often read the newspaper that fit their prejudices, just like we're talking about here. As the business model changed, as we went to more and more cities that had only one newspaper and the Associated Press, and they took on more of the role of being, you know, we're really going to check this out, or at least we're going to be fair. We'll quote this side, we'll quote that side, we'll call it good. So people got to the point where they said, well, you know, if it's in the paper, it's probably true. Probably. And then, but they carry this over now into reading the internet, and there's almost this kind of, well, it must be true, or I wouldn't be seeing it. Somebody vets this stuff, you know, or I wouldn't be seeing it. No, nobody vets this stuff except you. That's what businesses like the Tribune have to sell, is that we vet this stuff, and now we're more and more likely to be a little bit more aggressive about vetting it instead of just saying, well, the president says this, the Democrat says that, we give you both of them, we're done, we've done our job. Now we're a lot more likely to say, the president said this, it wasn't true. And because there are so many sources out there that might lead you to believe it is true, so instead of leaving it out there for you to figure it out, or letting the other political party call them on it, and we report that, and we call it good, we're going to have to do more calling people out, and our audiences are going to have to be at least as intelligent about consuming news as they are about choosing a car and buying a computer and things like that, to be an intelligent consumer.
Even in the months since the election, though, the term fake news has changed its definition, and now people use it as a way to distinguish between what they like and what they don't like.
That's not true. You're fake news.
Yeah, I know.
Right. Well, President Trump tweeted in February, fake news media, the failing New York Times, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, these are not my enemy. These are the enemy of the American people. Right? And so then John McCain, shortly after that, said, no, we need the press. It's vital to our democracy. We have to have the press, and sometimes it needs to be adversarial. But I think these charges of, that's fake news. And so when I asked my neighbors about this, that's kind of the answer that I got, is what you're referring to. I think it's biased. What they perceive as biased news, they're now calling fake news. And I think the president has started that trend.
No, the president has not started that trend. That trend is so much older than
this president. He's reinforced it.
Among a certain demographic, yeah, but you know what? The polar opposite political demographic has been making that argument for 25 years. I could not, as a young reporter in Oregon, I could not put a single word in our newspaper without having somebody on the polar political left tell me that I was fake news. This is not new to Trump. It's not unique to Trump.
They didn't use that term.
Well, it doesn't matter. They use the term. They've said that the news media is illegitimate. Right? So whether you call it fake news or you say, you know, like the corporate media empire, or you're sold, or you're just, like, however you do it, it's been being done long before Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump's really good at is putting a name on things, right? That he just, like, say what you will about Donald Trump, he's really good at that, right? So, yeah, sure, like, he's essentially, like, created a new definition for the words fake news. But the undercutting of mainstream, so to speak, news media
didn't start with Donald Trump, it won't end with Donald Trump, and it's not a problem of the right, it's a problem of the left and the right.
I agree with that.
George?
People have always looked at the newspaper, and if there's an article on the front page that fits their prejudices, it'll be, well, it's in the newspaper, it must be true. And then they'll turn to page 3, and in the same newspaper, there's an article that doesn't fit their prejudices, and they'll say, well, damn, newspaper never gets anything right. I mean, my first job as a reporter at a really small newspaper included, among many other things, putting down when the sunrise and the sunset were going to be the next day. I had this laminated piece of paper that told you the sunrise and sunset for every day of the year, and it was from Wichita, so you had to add like 12 minutes, and then you had to change it for daylight savings time, and God forbid you get that wrong, because then everybody looks at that and they say, well, you got the sunrise wrong. What else is wrong in the paper today, especially if you're predisposed not to believe it because it doesn't fit your prejudices? And in western Kansas, duck season begins at sunrise. So you get that wrong, you're in trouble.
So what's a poor reporter supposed to do? The journalists out there, we're human, so we're going to make a mistake. But anytime there's an error, fake news, right?
Keep doing what journalists have done as a principle, an ethical principle of our occupation for a very long time now, which nobody else does. You like name me another profession that when it screws up, publishes its mistakes. Lets everybody know. Doctors don't do it. Lawyers don't do it. Teachers don't do it. Police officers don't do it. Right? Journalists, if they are acting ethically, when they make a mistake, they publish the mistake. We've gotten away from that largely because we make our mistakes online, and they're really easy. They're a lot easier to fix online than they are in print. You could do it a lot faster. We should double down on that as journalists, because that's what distinguishes, if you're looking for an easy way to figure it out, right? Is this news organization real? Is this news organization fake? One of the starting places, not the start and finishing place, but one of the starting places is, does this organization acknowledge, correct, and own its mistakes?
I would argue too that I think journalism, especially at the higher levels, are much more likely to just show somebody the door. I mean, you can name people that have worked for the New York Times and have worked for the Washington Post. The editors found out what they were saying was plagiarized or false, and they were out. No appeals, no lawsuits, no anything. They were gone, and nobody else will hire them. They're poison. I mean, maybe in the sciences you'll find that, but I don't think you find that in too many other professions. And in the short term, it looks bad, because we're publicizing the fact that we screwed up. But over time, I think it is fair to say that we do a better job than almost any other profession of policing ourselves, because we don't want to be poisoned by some of this, and we want to be the first one to say it's wrong. We don't want to wait for somebody else to say you got it wrong. We want to say it first.
George argued that there's a heightened responsibility on consumers. How do you teach media literacy? Do we talk about it enough, Galen?
I would love to see a class on media literacy starting in elementary school and going all the way through the school system. I think it's really important. And we could call it citizenship, you know, how to be a citizen rather than just a consumer in the society. But I think it would be very valuable. I teach first year writing. UVU is an open enrollment school. And we try to emphasize critical thinking. But some people in the field have said, really, we should have writing classes be an analysis of national public rhetoric. It's at the point where that needs to happen. And not everybody agrees. But I think you could make a case for it. And you could say being able to distinguish validity from non-validity is a really important skill for writing itself.
What's that discussion at Utah State in your classes?
I don't know that there is a discussion. I mean, I think everybody agrees. I don't know a colleague in higher education that doesn't think that we need more critical thinking classes, more critical thinking skills. I've said for a very long time that we need to add a fourth R to reading, writing, arithmetic, and reporting, and that should start in kindergarten. Should start in kindergarten. We're all going to be part of the process. It is an essential part of our citizenship. It's an essential part of our humanity now. We have these entire lives that are lived online, and we don't teach children how to live them. At some point, my daughter's in the fourth grade. She came home the other day, and they said they started talking to me about internet safety at school. And I thought, well, that's really good, but you know, when are we going to start talking to children in elementary school about internet accuracy, about vetting material, about all these other things? We're so freaked out that somebody's going to prey on them, and I guess that's good that we're freaked out in that way, I suppose, but we're preying on ourselves, too, by not integrating these skills into the curriculum at a very, very young age. We can't wait until college. We can't wait until high school. My daughter's got a cell phone. I mean, she's on. She's living her life online, just like we all are now. The education needs to come now. Sorry, kid.
I remember teaching a class, and a beginner reporting class, everybody was like, oh, my best source is Wikipedia. It has gotten better. It's gotten safety measures in it embedded now. But wow, these are college students.
Yeah, well, even Wikipedia, the good thing about Wikipedia is it tells you where it got its information. Yeah. And if you will click through, if you will look at those, and then you can see, okay, this came from the New York Times, and maybe it's been corrected since it was on there originally. This came from God knows where. And you look at these things, and you have to, you have to vet this stuff. And it depends. If you're looking for, a movie review, maybe you don't have to worry too much about, the accuracy of it. If you're looking for the information you're going to use to vote, then you would certainly hope that you would not just say, oh, it says right here this, so I'm going to make my decision based on this. I mean, people who wouldn't buy toothpaste with that little information are voting.
Anything to add, Galen?
Well, for centuries, one of the most stressed subjects through education was the study of rhetoric. Rhetoric and composition. And they say, you've got a degree in that? Aristotle said rhetoric was a power to see all the available means of persuasion. And if we have that power, then we're not going to be fooled. If we can see and recognize all those means of persuasion. So I think training in rhetoric would be very valuable and something we should put back into the curriculum, whether we call it rhetoric or we call it meter literacy. I don't care what the name is, but that kind of education would be a really good thing.
I was in high school, and a girl next to me was reading a book by Angela Davis, and she looked up and said to the teacher, what's rhetoric? And the teacher gave her the classical definition of rhetoric, a dialogue, a back and forth. And she looked back at the book and she says, I don't think that's what Angela Davis means by rhetoric. What she meant was, the powers that be talking down to you and telling you lies and getting you to know your place. That's what she meant by the word rhetoric. So the word, like fake news and argument, argument used to be, more of a civilized give and take, and now it's like throwing dishes.
All depends on definition.
I want to get to some questions from our audience. If you'll wait for the microphone, though, because this is being broadcast on KCPW as well as at sltrib.com. Matt Canham, our senior managing editor, is going to be circulating.
Run those stairs, Matt.
Anyone have a question?
Oh, my other top. Okay, here we go.
I'm sorry, is it Mr. LaPlante, Dr. LaPlante?
Hi.
Yes, professor. Hi, professor, thank you.
Matthew's fine.
Matthew. I'm wondering, I enjoyed your response a few minutes ago. You're quite excited about, Donald Trump didn't start this, he wasn't the first to do this or that or that. Would you agree, however, that he's the first to bring it to the White House in such a strong manner, and that he and his close supporters are the first to bring it to such a popular national level?
President Trump lives in a different media era than his predecessors, even his immediate predecessor. He is definitely a different character than we have had in the White House in a very long time. I do not believe that his relationship with the truth is the relationship that we have come to expect of our leaders. That said, my expectation from our political leaders of the truth is way down low anyway, so it's not like the bar was set that high to begin with. We live in a different era. We have a very different president. I'm not his biggest fan by any means, but I'm not going to stand here and tell you that the guy is the first liar to sit in the Oval Office. He's not. We've impeached presidents for that within most lifetimes of the people here. No, I don't think there's something all that different. The difference is the guy knows how to tweet.
And that is so fascinating. Social media has given this almost immediate window into this man's head. And gosh, sometimes it's not pretty.
No,
George?
In history, you know, Roosevelt was the man who mastered radio, and so he became the most popular. And Kennedy was the guy who looked good on TV, and so he did well. Obama, you know, just kind of coming into the internet age, still he was more of a creature of television, I think, than the internet. And now Trump has mastered this idea of this instant out there and challenging the rest of the world to try and catch up. And it's not like he sat down 20 years ago and said, I'm going to master this so I can be president. He just is good at it.
Well, I think it's fascinating to think about his staff running around trying to react to all of his tweets. But I find that kind of amusing. All right.
Hi. Thanks so much for having this wonderful presentation. In the last election, it seemed to me that one of the things that stood out is how divided our country is. And one thing that illustrated that to me was I heard Obama's farewell speech. I thought it was a fantastic speech, covered everything, loved every bit of it. But then I switched it over to Fox News, and Sean Hannity came on, and he said, finally, the long Obama nightmare is over. And then he went on to say that unemployment isn't down, it's up. That crime isn't down, it's up. And so the people that listen to Rush Limbaugh, Fox News, are coming from a total different fact base in their minds than people that read the New York Times or whatever. And my theory, and I believe that in history we'll show this, is that the combination of factors are Rush Limbaugh, Fox News, putting their information out there that people listen to and believe without checking anything. And then on top of that, you've got the Koch brothers' money, who funds all these things. They funded the Tea Party. There's a fantastic book, Dark Money, by Jane Mayer, about the power of that money. It's not just the money, but the organization behind it. And to me, it's those two things that have created the base of support for Donald Trump and the Republicans in general.
You put a
general.
Lot out there. Do you have a question?
That is it.
All right.
Well, I read something the other day, and there was a scientific survey with all these equations and sigmas and things that I didn't understand. But basically, it didn't talk about fake news. It didn't talk about believing fake news. It talked about political polarization. And they said that political polarization is very strong among people who don't tweet and don't Facebook. And they're mostly because they're just of a generation where they didn't develop that habit. And it didn't say the words Fox News, and it didn't say the words Rush Limbaugh, but you could kind of look at this and say that why are they polarized? Well, it's not from Facebook because they don't have Facebook. It's from the more traditional media of radio and television that, you know, that is completely passive on the part of the people who are watching it. They're not retweeting, they're not sharing, they're just listening and watching and having this build up over time, and then they do surveys later on and they find out, you know, they ask people, you know, what happened in Iraq and what happened in Afghanistan and what happened here and what happened there, and people who watch Fox News get it wrong. They're more wrong than people who don't watch news at all. And this has been documented. And it's not Facebook and Twitter. It's the more traditional media.
This was a point you were arguing earlier, Galen.
Well, I was thinking of saying a little bit of something else. This idea of confirmation bias, I mean, what really is it psychologically? And a French psychologist who was studying propaganda called it crystallization. He said if we have a prejudice already, and then we hear propaganda, that will become hardened. And I like that picture. You know, it's hardened within us, and we can't dislodge it, because the more we hear it, the more affirmation we get, and we say, oh, okay, I was right all along. Maybe I was embarrassed about this prejudice, but other people are saying it, and they're saying it out loud. And so we just get these prejudices crystallized in our soul, more or less, and I think that helps me understand what confirmation bias is, at least.
Anything to add, Matt?
I think we are more susceptible to believing the things that we want to hear when we feel like we're in a position of lessened power, when we feel like things are being taken away from us. So I would challenge everyone who thinks that the people who are watching Fox News right now and listening to Rush Limbaugh right now are somehow stupider human beings or more susceptible, or they're just older and they're just a product of their time, to consider where you're going to be in about 8 years if Donald Trump is still president. Because you will feel like you don't have the power, that the power has been taken away from you. And we're already seeing this. You're probably already seeing it in your social media circles. You're probably already seeing it in your friend circles. Liberals are becoming more susceptible to being fooled by fake news right now, because you feel like your power is being taken away from you. So this is not a liberal conservative problem. This is a human problem. And it's a problem that if we don't all face together as liberals, conservatives, and everything else, we're gonna die by.
Arguments for the discriminating consumer. Yes, sir?
Quick question. Would this be an example of the confirmational biases when Donald Trump said, they love me, I could go out on Fifth Avenue and shoot someone, and they'd still support me?
Fake news?
That was real. Well, yeah, I mean,
right.
He said that, but yeah, he was confident that he had made his case, that he had built his base, and that there was nothing he could do to erase that. And you could make the argument, based on what we've seen, that something to that.
Right up top.
So it seems like there's a little differentiation between fake news being stuff we don't agree with or that is critical of us or of our president, let's say, and fake news that's demonstrably false.
Fiction.
So in our system, we abhor government censorship. But it seems like in this, you know, internet age, we have to learn how to self-censor. And I wonder if you were teaching an elementary school class like you want to, or you're teaching some of us who are technological dinosaurs and are grudgingly coming into the technological age and didn't grow up in it. How do you self-censor to distill out the demonstrably false stuff and not just stuff we don't agree with?
Thoughts?
Part of Galen. It is practicing, I think, virtues, what I call rhetorical virtues, of civility, of trying to find common ground, of listening, of patience, of persistence. If we're angry, mixing that up with some logic. I think that if we can develop those skills and practice them and see examples of it, that it would go a long ways.
Matt?
Slow down. You don't need to reply immediately. You don't need to share immediately. This is something that, this is actually a gift that the traditional media gave to the social media, the scoop, right? You want to be the first person to tell everybody everything, right? You're not going to be. You won't. You're not going to be the first person. So slow down. This is a lesson that the traditional media needs to learn also. Slow down, take your time, cool your heads, and especially if you find yourself saying,
that totally confirms the way I feel about the world. That's the moment. That is your better angels telling you, take a chill pill. Give it a moment. Do some searching. Check with some other people. Come back to it. Because you're not going to be the first to share it anyway. The scoop is dead.
And it's been said by Colin Powell and other people, it probably goes back to Sen Shu or something, the first reports from the battlefield are always wrong. I mean, generals learn that if they want to be generals. So news consumers, I think, should keep that in mind, too.
Probably have time for one or two quick questions. Yeah, right there.
Hi, I'm a journalism student, and I'm wondering what you guys think about the future of media, because there's a big split happening right now between the Rachel Maddows and the Sean Hannitys of the world, who have an explicit bent, and the AP style, where you try your best to not have a bias, but everyone already has a bias, so what do you think is the best way? Should you try your best to not have one and have one anyway, or just be honest about what your bias is?
Good question. You're a brave soul to enter this realm. Matt.
You're a smart soul to enter this realm. This is an exciting time for media. It's an exciting time to be a journalist. Here's your way. Your way is the way. As long as your way is honest and transparent. I'm a big believer in transparency. If you got a bias and you can't get rid of it, just let people know. Then they can judge you based on your biases. And if you think that you operate better, like as a clean slate, then operate as a clean slate. But make sure people know that too. Like I don't have any problem with Sean Hannity. We all know who Sean Hannity is. I don't have any problem with Rachel Maddow. The other day she was really boring for like 37 minutes before. But I don't have any problem with those people existing. Rush Limbaugh, God bless him, super. Everybody knows who Rush Limbaugh is, okay? At least Rush Limbaugh is transparent. We know who he is. We can judge him accordingly. So do the way that's your way. Choose your way and go with that, because there's an avenue for you in this brave new media world. Just be transparent. Let people know who you are.
And just to be clear, Rachel Maddow is not a journalist. She's an entertainer, as is Rush Limbaugh. I would say that they are there for ratings. That's my cynical take. Okay, one last question.
Yes. Did Columbus really discover America? Does Donald Trump really have big hands?
Well, you're looking at like fake news and how far back it goes. It was like more than 1,000 years ago that the Norse explorers called Iceland Greenland and Greenland Iceland to influence where the settlers went. So it's not new.
Thoughts? Yeah, Matt.
I'm not going to comment on President Trump's hands. What I will say is this. I'm going to comment on President Trump's hand, because the other day, and a bunch of y'all shared this, I know, because some of you are my Facebook friends, we all got convinced that President Trump was dissing the German chancellor, right? Like, we all said, oh my gosh, like, he's the worst guy in the world. Never mind that the Associated Press reported that he shook her hand before that meeting and after that meeting, and there are photographs of him shaking her hand before that meeting and at that meeting. Never mind that the cameras were moving a mile a minute, and that if you watch the video, I don't know, you guys, maybe you have better ears than I do, but I didn't hear her ask for a handshake, and I didn't even hear the media ask for a handshake. Now, maybe they did. I believe they did, because that was reported too. And maybe President Trump was being a jerk, because you know what? I think he's prone to that. He really is. But you don't know what happened in that room. You don't. You make an assumption, you share that assumption, and you're no better than President Trump is when he tweets something that's not true. Fair enough.
Okay, final question for each of you, and maybe you can just keep it real short. Okay, so fake news. This term came out late fall. 6 months later, it has a different meaning. What are we going to be talking about in 6 months? What is fake news going to morph into something else? George?
Well, I think, I mean, if these investigations get any deeper into Russian connections and things like that, then one of the things he's going to be doing, because anybody in power will do this, is try and undermine the validity, the public's faith in the people who are investigating him, whether it's Congress or the press. So assuming this doesn't go away, and I doubt that it's going to go away, then what we're going to be talking about in 6 months is who is fit to throw the first stone and the second and the third and the fourth, and who is doing a proper job of investigating both Congress and the press, and who is believable as they do this. And he'll cry fake news, and people who disagree with him will cry fake news. But you know, to a degree, you know, because of the rapid movement of everything, that's almost over already. I mean, Margaret Sullivan said we shouldn't even use the term fake news anymore because it's been hijacked by the White House to mean anything I don't like. And that isn't what it meant 6 months ago.
Galen?
Well, I don't know, of course, what's going to be talked about in 6 months, but I'm concerned that we are becoming increasingly a society where those who are poor, those who are disadvantaged in some way, don't really have a voice. And so I think the more power is concentrated, that we'll hear less and less from people that need to have a voice. And so I'm worried that we will ignore more people as we go forward.
And Matt?
I think we're going to be having the same discussion for a really long time because we have teamified the political spectrum. If you're a Yankees fan, if you've ever watched a Yankees Red Sox game with a Red Sox fan, you guys see two totally different ball games. It's the same ball game, but you see two different ball games, right? Yeah, I'm a soccer fan. I see this all the ref is always wrong when the call goes against my team. We can either acknowledge that that's happening and start taking steps toward fixing that problem within ourselves, or we can just decide that our political system is no more important than a baseball game. I think it is, and I think it behooves all of us to recognize that about ourselves and take a stand against allowing that to impact our news judgment and our, what I'll call, sharing judgment. We have the power to put a kibosh on this, but we have to take responsibility and we have to treat it like it's more important than a sports game.
Shameless plug, read the Salt Lake Tribune. We try every day to get it right. Thank you, panelists. Matt LaPlante, Galen Henderson, George Pyle, thank you all so much. Thanks to the City Library and Aleco Campos and KCPW for broadcasting live from all of us at the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for coming, and good night.